Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about this year's presidential campaign. There are certainly a number of features of the campaign that set it apart from others, among them the fact that it is the first in 40 years in which both major parties are nominating a new candidate. Our guest for the program, he's a political writer, Garrett Graff, says that there are other things that set this year's contest apart, issues perhaps, and also technology, particularly information technologies. This morning in this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about his book, The First Campaign, Globalization, the Web, and the Race for the White House. The book is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. It came out just at the end of last year. And the title suggests, as the title suggests, he makes this argument that for a variety of reasons, this is a first. Not just, for example, because we have the first African-American candidate, or it's the first in a long time where we have no incumbent, but it's also perhaps the first if you take a look at the role that globalized information technologies are playing. A little bit more about our guest for this hour, Garrett Graff. He is an editor at the Washingtonian Magazine, where he covers media and politics. He also edits the Capitol Comment section and serves as the internet director. He was the founding editor of Fishbowl DC, a popular blog covering the media and journalism in Washington. He's a native of Vermont. He served as the deputy national press secretary on Howard Dean's presidential campaign, and beginning in 1997, he was then Governor Dean's first webmaster. He was also the first blogger admitted to cover a White House briefing and speaks often on blogging and the intersection of politics and technology. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of people who call in is that just try to keep their comments brief so we can get as many callers in as possible. But anybody who is listening is certainly welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. If you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana, or you're listening on the internet across the country, the number is the same for you. That's 800-222-9455. So again, 333-WILL or 9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Graff, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
We certainly appreciate it. I'm not exactly sure where to start. I guess that there would have been a time when people thought for sure the big issue was going to be the Iraq war. And certainly there are a lot of people who continue to be very concerned about the U.S. involvement in Iraq and this question of when and how the troops will be withdrawn. But I think one of the things we certainly know about this year is that now concerns about the economy, issues like the price of gasoline and the price of food has eclipsed that. It's not that people don't think about that, but they're thinking about other things more importantly. So there at least has been a change there. And I know when you wrote and published this book, you were definitely looking at things that were domestic issues that had economic dimensions, like the economy, like education, like technology, and so forth. So having said all that, at this point now, as close as we are to people going to the polls, what do you think really will be the big things that will influence how people choose between Barack Obama and John McCain?
I think that there are a couple of major factors that we're seeing play out in this race. One is certainly the economy and the rising price of oil and how that is exposing a lot of stresses in the global economy that we weren't really prepared to deal with. But larger than that, though, is the way that all of these issues have woven themselves together in the last two decades or so. My book begins around 1980 and goes up to the present as one examines these intertwining and interweaving issues of globalization and technology and politics. Because it used to be that you could have, you know, domestic policy agendas and foreign policy agendas, and that those were separate and distinct, and that you could have a healthcare policy that stood on its own, and you could have an environmental policy that stood on its own, and you could have an education policy that stood on its own. And that now what we have, certainly coming into this election, are all of these issues are all tied up together, that you really can't begin to talk about, you know, say, our energy policy without also talking about our trade policy and our jobs policies and our education policies and even our healthcare policies. Healthcare, for example, if you want to begin talking about trade and the U.S. foreign trade debt and the trade imbalances around the world, well, U.S. companies spend vastly more on healthcare than companies overseas. So the United States is really the last major industrialized country that still puts the price of healthcare in the price of the products that we're selling. So you have a company like General Motors, which is struggling, to keep its head above water, but it's spending more on healthcare than it is on steel to make up its automobiles. And a car that GM makes, automatically starts out overseas with a $1,200 price disadvantage for foreign-made automobiles. And all of these issues really tie themselves together so that it's impossible to address one without really looking at the whole system and the whole process that we have in place today.
Mm-hmm. I think of going back to when Bill Clinton was running for office the first time, when the economy emerged as a big issue. And, of course, people remember the famous, the famous slogan that Carville coined. I think it was James Carville. That it's the economy, stupid. People remember that. And then we had a couple of elections where, it almost, looking back on them, one almost has to scratch your head and say, and what exactly was that election about? Is the place we're now in so different than the place we were when Bill Clinton ran for the first time and the economy was such a dominant issue?
Yes. One of the things that a lot of people forget looking back on that 92 election was just how big and just how deciding a factor the economy and healthcare really were. That the year before the presidential race in 1991, there was a special election to fill the Pennsylvania Senate seat that opened up when Senator John Hines was killed in a plane crash. And Harris Wofford, the Democrat, ran against Dick Thornburg, the Republican, and that race almost entirely came down to health care and the soaring costs of health care that people felt. And it was really that race that then led the Clintons to make such a big deal about their health care plan, which led them to make that big 1992, 93, 94 push for what we now remember as Hillary Care, Hillary Clinton's big initiative to provide universal health care. Now, there's one huge difference between now and the 1994 health care experience, and that's that business today is the leading proponent of health care reform. That certainly many Americans are struggling with health care and health care costs, but that today business really feels that it's at a competitive disadvantage to its, to companies in other parts of the world dealing with all of these crushing healthcare costs in the United States. And so what was in 1993-94 one of the biggest stumbling blocks, the opposition from business, is today I think one of the biggest reasons to be optimistic about reforms coming in the next administration one way or another.
Mm. Let me introduce again our guest, Garrett Graff. He's editor-at-large at Washingtonian Magazine, where he covers media and politics. He writes and speaks a lot about the intersection of politics and technology, and he's the author of the book, The First Campaign, Globalization, the Web, and the Race for the White House. It's published by Ferrer, Strauss, Giroux, and among other things, looks very closely at new and emerging information technologies, communications technologies, and how they have changed and and will continue to change politics. So if you're interested in that, you can go out and take a look at the book. And we have some folks here who want to join in the conversation, and you can do that too just by calling us 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we'll talk with some folks who are listening. We'll go to Belgium, the community not far from us, on our toll free line, line 4. Hello.
Good morning. How can I put this without stepping on anybody's toes? I can't understand for the life of me why the media has turned elections into such a game. You know particularly well with Mr. Dean. He makes a loud scream, and all of a sudden his candidacy is over with. This time here with Mr. McClain and Mr. Obama, Mr. Obama puts out a position in energy that goes on for several pages, but Mr. McClain picks up on the only thing he wants to talk about is tire pressure. But yet the media plays into these things. They allow the people who, pundits, whoever you want to call it, carry the election by talking about one little aspect of it, and then they can continue to push that aspect until it becomes overwhelming in the election, and we elect a person because of some snide remark or lack of snide remarks. I don't understand this. It seems like it's all a media game anymore and not really an election for the true values that we need to worry about.
I've been saying to my friends who cover politics here in Washington that I think that we would all be better off with about half as much political news coverage, just because there is now such a hunger for news and information on politics on all of these different channels that media is now published on, and that is really one of the driving forces of this race, is the way that so many reporters now write blogs and do video from the road, and so many bloggers are out there covering these stories every day, that there's just a tremendous interest in every little detail of the presidential race this year, partly because it's the most interesting presidential race that we have had in decades, if not, maybe a century or so. But additionally, I think a lot of it has to do with just the call and response that takes place in political journalism, where, you know, one side says something and the media calls the other person, you know, the other candidate for a response, and then there's your story, you know, two solid quotes going back and forth without ever really delving into any of the substance of any of the charges.
Precisely. That's exactly what the point I'm getting at. I mean, like you say, this is a fabulous election. I mean, what's going on here is monumental for us. But at the same time, we want to chase this perverse action. Well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks. Well, I think that some people would make the argument that the web, all of the people who have the opportunity to write whatever is on their mind and exchange ideas and exchange opinions and do research. The candidates certainly have the opportunity here to put out at great length position papers and to have some interactivity. That is, at least people have the opportunity to interact with the campaigns. And, you know, there's so much potential for people to put ideas and information out that bypass the more traditional kind of networks and the way of doing that. So all of that then goes to this question, well, now people, the potential at least is there. Do you think that it's being used, and is that making a positive contribution, and that is getting more real talk about real issues going?
Mm-hmm. I think that what we have, so the idea, and I think you introduced it well at the beginning of of our conversation. The idea of the first campaign, my book title, is that this is the first campaign of the information age, the first campaign of the 21st century. And what I mean by that is that we have in the past seen elections take place that have transformed the landscape for all future elections. There was the first election, that Franklin Roosevelt began to use the radio. Then there was the 1960 Kennedy-Nixon election, where Kennedy's use of the television really helped deliver him the presidency. Now what we're seeing are the candidates, and all of the candidates, really competing and playing online in ways that they had never done before. In 2000 and on the Dean campaign in 2004 that I worked on, there was some of it, but that it was not nearly at the level of sophistication or depth or breadth that we are seeing today. Just one example is that Hillary Clinton never actually made a presidential announcement speech. What she did was she posted a video on her website saying that she was going to run for president. There was no giant rally with balloons and bunting and teleprompters and crowds and, you know, wild sign waving. She decided to bypass all of that and just go right online, and anyone who was interested in listening to her could go on and listen to her video. So now what you're having is, and this goes right to your question about the policies and the way that we're really talking about these issues, that for the first time since effectively the end of the whistle-stop train tours with Harry Truman, people can watch in entire presidential speeches start to finish. So Barack Obama's big speech on race earlier this year in Philadelphia ran for about 38 minutes. Now, you know, maybe a minute of that, if he's lucky, would be shown on the evening news. And certainly if you didn't watch it live on the cable channels, you had sort of missed your opportunity to see it. But through all sorts of different media, through cell phones and social networking platforms and email and the campaign blog and all of these different ways, the campaign really pushed that speech out. And they posted it on YouTube, where now something like 8 million people have watched the speech start to finish, all 37-38 minutes of it, which is just a level of engagement and interaction with a campaign that people had just never been able to have before in the age of television.
We have another caller here. Let's get on to them. This is someone in Paw Paw, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. How is everybody this morning?
Fine, thanks.
Very well.
You know what? I like this blogger thing and internet access, but the only downfall is, and it's a known fact, that you don't know where you're getting your information from, because story after story, I read it. It's like in every other paper I read on a daily basis or on a TV at night, that there's these falsehoods out there. There's, people writing up stories and find out they're later, not true. The information that's out there could be twisted or slanted one way or the other. And, it's like the information the gentleman before me called in about, he's kind of right, he's kind of wrong. The point I'm getting at is that if you look and you read behind each candidate, your duty as a citizen of this country, am I not correct, to do the research on who he or she is going to vote for, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and there's gobs of information behind it. Now, he brought up the fact that about energy policies. Well, everybody out there that I know of, including, any congressman and senator out there, they've all had both sides of the fence, their chance to enact energy policies in this country in the last 20 years, since Ronald Reagan. And nobody's done it because it doesn't benefit them. It benefits big business, or it doesn't benefit big business. I mean, they're forcing the issue here. The point I'm trying to make here is that, again, it goes back to the research on the blogging, especially the blogging. Everybody out there knows, who's running. For instance, we're talking politics and what they stand for. And to me, I've done a research on Obama, and he has really not, to me, contributed all that much, as far as the state's concerned, to this, the state or the country.
Mm-hmm.
He hasn't been in politics all that long, and people forget about that.
Yeah, you raise the, I think, one of the interesting challenges in this race in particular is this question of, you know, who are the reporters and who are the people gathering the information and where is the information coming from? And what we have seen in this election is a trend towards ordinary people contributing to the coverage and to the stories in ways that the traditional media does not. That there's a lot more conversation. That there's there are blogs that are more advocates for viewpoints than they are objective observers of fact. But at the same time, I think that they've made a very valuable contribution to this race by broadening the diversity of voices that are out there in the media and covering this race, and also holding the traditional media more accountable for what they're saying and what they're writing. Political journalists often have a habit of writing in shorthand in the way that they phrase things that doesn't capture, as you're saying, the nuance and the depth of the conversations that are actually taking place. And that the bloggers have done a very good job of addressing that and arresting that as a trend, and making people more careful about what they're writing and what they're saying. Now, this leads to another question, which is how do you know who you can trust online? And the short answer is that there isn't an easy way to do that, but there are certainly some sites out there like TalkingPointsMemo.com, which is a progressive blog that actually won the George Polk Award for investigative reporting for the work that they did around the U.S. Attorney's firing scandal last year. The George Polk Award being one of the highest awards in journalism for investigative reporting. And that the way that this trend is moving is that the best blogs, the most reliable blogs, are becoming much more like the traditional news media. And the traditional news media, the best sites there are also becoming much more like the best blogs. That you see sites like Politico.com, which is a Washington, D.C. print newspaper that launched primarily to be an online vehicle for political coverage, and that they have done a great job covering this race with very little in the way of a print circulation, that most of what people read about them and most of their product actually comes through online reporting.
Well, if, I suppose there are some people that say, if the particularly these big sites that have that are well respected and that have become very popular and have a lot of readers, like the ones you've mentioned, or the Daily Kos, or the Huffington mm-hmm. Post, or you know, there are a lot of them. I mean, if they're becoming more like traditional media, and say maybe the difference between something like that and Time, Newsweek, The Economist, The New York mm-hmm. Times, if the difference between them is closing, are we losing what made the blogosphere special in the first place?
That's a good question. I think not. I think what instead we are seeing is a maturation of both forms of media and both forms of writing. That for too long the media relied on this objective artifice that resulted in reporting that sort of said, you know, he said, she said, who knows, where you would end up with these articles where people said, you know, John McCain said yesterday the sky was blue. Barack Obama said the sky was green. You know, we leave it up to the reader to make their own decision about who is right. That you see organizations like the Associated Press, which has been traditionally one of the most most heavily objective and just the facts style, dragnet-like reporting, moving this summer saying that they're going to try to inject a little more objective truth and objective analysis into their reporting, such that, you know, you could say in an article now, you know, John McCain said the sky is blue, Barack Obama said the sky is green. Most people doubt that that Barack Obama is right, that the sky is green.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Garrett Graff. He is editor at the Washingtonian magazine, where he covers media and politics. He also edits the Capital Comment section. He serves as internet director. He's the founding editor of Fishbowl DC, which was a popular blog covering media and journalism in Washington. He was the first blogger admitted to cover a White House press briefing and speaks and writes often on blogging and the intersection of politics and technology. He's a native of Vermont. He served as deputy national press secretary on Howard Dean's presidential campaign, and beginning in 1997, he was then Governor Dean's first webmaster. He's the author of the book, The First Campaign. The subtitle of the book is Globalization, the Web, and the Race for the White House. It is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, and as he explained, he in a sense is saying, picks that title because he says this really is the first campaign of the information age, and the book tries to look at the various ways that particularly information technology has changed politics. Questions welcome 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. I'm interested in having you talk about the way that candidates and campaigns are using the web. Now, one of the things that certainly they have discovered, and perhaps indeed it was the Dean campaign that really made this first discovery, is the potential to use the web to raise money. And certainly particularly I think Senators Clinton and Obama raised a lot of money through the web, and from small in the form of small contributions. So a lot of individuals giving a relatively small amount of money and made possible for both those campaigns to raise a lot of money. Aside from that, aside from raising money, are there ways in which you think the candidates are making constructive use of the web, particularly to talk about what it is they think is important and what they would do if they were elected?
Barack Obama's online fundraising is certainly the headline of this election in terms of what has taken place so far. It was really the small dollar online fundraising that allowed him to beat Hillary Clinton and take on the best money machine the Democratic Party had ever assembled in the Clinton family. That said, though, the online organizing work that he's doing through his website, my.barackobama.com, I think will be the key to his victory this November if he ends up winning. And what I mean by that is that he has about 5 million people on his campaign email list right now, which makes it, depending on whose numbers you believe, the second or third largest email list in the country in terms of political organizations, and certainly the largest on the Democratic side. And of that 5 million, about 800,000 people have gotten involved in the my.barackobama.com portal site, where people can go on and sign up and begin to take action on behalf of the campaign in the very traditional offline field activities that campaigns are built upon, you know, knocking on doors, canvassing undecided voters, calling undecided voters, you know, getting people to register to vote, those types of things. And that he has just had a tremendous impact building a national campaign apparatus through this grassroots supporter network that he's built online, such that when they were going through all of these, 57 primary contests this spring, one of the most interesting aspects of it was the way that Obama's paid staff would show up in a state to begin to organize, and they would have a grassroots network that had been in place and at work for a year or longer, dating back, to the candidate's announcement in February 2007, when my.barackobama.com first launched, that this network had already been out there canvassing voters, calling undecided voters, knocking on doors, doing visibility, you know, holding signs at farmers markets and those types of things. And that really helped Obama win many of those smaller states that were so key to his victories against the Clintons and their longstanding political apparatus and network around the country.
Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Do you think here that the perception that people will have about the candidate's personal comfort level with these new technologies is going to make a difference? And I don't want to please don't think I'm being ageist about this, because, you know, I'm not all that comfortable with these technologies either. It seems to be one of those things that the younger you are, the more it's always been a part of your life, the more comfortable you are going to be with it.
Yep.
So and on that count, there seems to be indeed a difference between Senator McCain and Senator Obama. And I guess I just wonder how many people the fact that different comfort level exists, whether that's a particular issue or not. The important thing is that people in the campaign have the comfort level, and if the candidate doesn't, well, maybe that doesn't matter.
I'm actually glad you asked this question, because this has been something that I've spent a lot of time talking and writing about this year. I think it matters a great deal. I don't think that you can be an effective leader in 2008 in the United States and not have a pretty solid understanding of technology and the way that it has changed society, our economy, our culture, and certainly the way that business works. And what I mean by that is that for too long, I think we have tolerated and thought it was cute when people didn't understand technology. That there was a lot of machismo in the late 1990s in business for business executives who didn't use email, you know, who printed everything out and only worked on paper, and the FBI director in the 1990s, Louis Free, made a big point of the fact that he wanted the computer taken out of his office because he didn't think that, you know, that it was a useful tool to him. Well, what that meant was that, in his case, in the case of the FBI didn't get technology for a long time. When September 11th happened, its agents didn't have email. Its agents didn't have internet access. There was no real computer system in place for the Bureau. And that we've seen that begin to play out across government, where the fact that we have leaders who don't understand technology, don't understand the way that technology has changed our world and our economy and our culture, means that they're making bad decisions about how to move our country forward and the technologies and the tools that are necessary to do that. And so it doesn't matter to me at any level whether John McCain personally uses email or writes a blog if he becomes president or whatever. I would hope that he doesn't do any of that. The president of the United States has access to communications apparatus and staff and processes that the whole rest of the world doesn't have access to. So if the next president doesn't blog, I'm fine with that. What I'm more concerned about is the fact that in the last decade, while the internet and technology and computers have changed absolutely everything in American life, that John McCain never had the intellectual curiosity to say, I really should understand this. I really should try to figure this stuff out so that I know how to make good decisions about where we need to be placing our resources. We wouldn't really tolerate this level of ignorance on any other major policy issue, and so I don't know why we let it happen in technology. You know, we wouldn't let John McCain sit there and say, well, you know, Sunni, Shiite, I don't really understand the difference. I don't really think it matters, but, you know, I have staff who will figure that stuff out. And we wouldn't let, you know, Chris Dodd, the chair of the Senate Banking Committee, sit around and say, well, I don't really have any idea about subprime mortgages or any of this housing stuff or even what Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae really do. But, you know, I have staff who will figure that out. And so I don't understand, given that we ask our leaders to have knowledge about the decisions that they're making, why we let them just skip over, I think, what will be one of the most important driving forces of the next 50 years of the American economy.
Well, you know, Senator McCain sits on the Commerce Committee, and among the things that that committee is concerned with has to do with technology research and development. I mean, how do we really know that he's not on top of these things?
Because he's admitted it himself. He actually went on a whole push in July to try to counter some of these accusations that he doesn't understand technology, explaining that, you know, his wife is teaching him how to use a computer and that he's, you know, his staff is, you know, will show him a blog, you know, once a day or something like that. But that, you know, then, you know, John McCain really isn't alone in this. Ted Stevens, the Alaska senator, who was actually indicted last week on various corruption charges, he was, back in the summer of 2006, probably a lot of listeners will remember the famous "the internet is not a dump truck, it's a series of tubes" speech that he gave. Well, at the time, Ted Stevens was the senator in charge of the committee that regulated and ran the internet. And the fact that Ted Stevens in that speech didn't understand the difference between the internet and an email, and so he actually said, you know, I have, you know, my staff sends me internets all day long, and that, you know, sometimes they get held up and I don't get them till the next day, that's a huge problem for me. I mean, a lot of this stuff is technical, but I would hope that the person who is in charge of regulating the internet in the United States Senate would at least have the technical knowledge to know the difference between the internet and an email message.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk with someone else. We have someone calling on a cell phone on our toll-free line. This is line 4. Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you a question about the my.barackobama.com community website. I'm actually a supporter, but I wanted to ask you if you could just kind of weigh in on any potential negatives of having like a user-generated content format community like that. It's my understanding that there have been some people who have created profiles or whatnot that almost intentionally conflict with his, you know, positions and whatnot, and just kind of how people might use that or any issues that might arise thereof. And I'll listen for your answer offline. Thank you.
All right.
This is, you know, one of the great challenges of the campaigning in the web era is that anything you say and anything that you create can and will be used against you. I call it the Miranda era of politics. What I think is so interesting is that for the amount of energy and the amount of enthusiasm for the my.barackobama.com site, just how few instances there have been of abuse. That for the most part, you really haven't seen that many examples where people have gone on and used these tools for evil instead of good on behalf of the Obama campaign. And that I think that that's a real testament to the strength of the communities and the types of feedback mechanisms built into these sites that keep people engaged and interested and, you know, wanting to help the Obama campaign.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. And again, just quickly, our guest is Garrett Graff. He's editor at the Washingtonian Magazine. He writes and speaks a lot about the intersection of politics and technology. He was founding editor of Fishbowl DC, a popular blog covering the media and journalism in Washington. He was the first blogger admitted to cover a White House press briefing. Questions welcome, 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. We were talking a little bit earlier about the shift now towards economic issues in this year's campaign. That's what's on a lot of people's mind. In the book, you make the argument that there are four really basic issues that you think are important, and all of them really do indeed have to do with the economic strength of the country and the ability of the United States to compete globally in the economy. And roughly speaking, they have to do with education, healthcare, technology, and energy.
Mm-hmm.
Those broad areas. And you've got a chapter in here on each one of those things. So each one, we could spend a lot of time talking about any one of those things. I guess I'm wondering what it is that you would, what would you like to hear about these things? What would you like to hear from the candidates in regards to these four big areas?
Marjorie Williams, who was a Vanity Fair writer here in Washington for a long time, once said that the truly big problems in Washington are never actually the faults of any single person, that they just sort of creep along until they become so big that everyone has to wake up and notice. And I think that that's where we really are today. And I think that that's reflected in the mood of the electorate and voters today, that we have these creeping crises in education and healthcare and energy and the environment and the thing that I add to this conversation in the book is this question of the tech infrastructure that you know, we don't have particularly robust cell phone networks, we don't have particularly robust broadband internet networks and all of that type of stuff. And that I think what I would like to hear the candidates say is really give a good vision for where they think that the country needs to be 20 or 30 or 40 years down the road. Because these are not questions and these are not problems that we can turn around in the space of a year or two. It's going to be the investments and decisions that the next president makes, whether he has 4 years or 8 years, will really help determine whether the United States is able to remain competitive in this globalized, tech-driven society over the next half century, and whether we begin to move down the road towards a healthcare system that provides more universal access and doesn't punish employers and self-employed people, whether we have an education system that reflects the skills and the training that we need for an increasingly tech-driven workforce, whether we have an environmental policy that's sustainable and that creates jobs and builds innovation and all of that, and whether we have a foreign policy that also wraps up all of these questions, and whether we have the tech infrastructure that allows us to create the jobs that we need over the rest of this half century. I think that there is this real challenge that we have where the government in previous eras has stepped up to make the investments in our commercial infrastructure necessary to facilitate the economy. The beginning of the country, you saw the government building the first canals to help move goods around the country. Then you had the government building the transcontinental railroad system in the mid-1800s that really helped power the growth of a national economy. And then in the 1950s, you had Dwight Eisenhower make the realization that we needed a good road system to move all of these mass-produced goods around the country, and that's what led to the interstate highway system. Today, though, there is no equivalent effort to bring the United States online. And so, particularly in the rural parts of the country, there's very poor infrastructure for broadband internet, for cell phones, for all of these technologies, that when you talk to people, it will be much more devastating to be left off the internet and to be left off broadband and cell phone networks than it was to be left off the transcontinental railroads in the 1800s.
Well, this and here, it's interesting we got to this point because it seems to me that this points to a very, very, very basic divide, philosophical divide, particularly between the two parties, that has to do with the relative roles of government and private business,
right,
and who it is that should be doing this and who it is that should be paying for it.
Yep. The Democrats and the Republicans have just really fundamental differences about a lot of these issues. While they can at least mostly agree that there are major challenges and problems in all of these systems ahead, one of the interesting sidebars in the book, though, is the way that the creative economy, that the jobs that rely most on technology and, sort of the new economy jobs, skew so much more Democratic than they do Republican. And there are a number of different reasons for it, but there's a professor who's now at the University of Toronto named Richard Florida, who's done a lot of work on the creative class and what makes the new economy compelling, and that this is actually an election where there will be more creative economy, new economy workers in the workforce than there are traditional blue-collar workers. So it's a big change in the workforce and the electorate. Well, Richard Florida has shown that there's three things necessary for the growth of a creative center. One is technology, which makes sense. One is talent, which makes sense. You need education and you need a skilled workforce in order to be doing a lot of these jobs. The third, though, is that you need a tolerant society. And that to me is one of the most interesting aspects of this question and the rise of the creative class as an electoral force in the United States, because there is not a single tech center anywhere in the United States that's a Republican base. You go to any of them, Austin, Texas, Raleigh, Durham, Boston, New York, Chicago, Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, even the Denver area to an increasing degree. Those are entirely Democratic-leaning regions now, and that's largely because of the way that those communities have built tolerant and diverse societies. And that I really think that this is going to be a long-term problem for the Republican Party if their party seems increasingly out of touch with the needs and desires of the, what is the fastest-growing sector in the American workforce today.
We just have a couple of minutes left, and we've also come to a point that I wanted at least to touch on, and that is the digital divide, as been called. That is the mm-hmm. fact that there is still, even though access to the technology is growing and people's, the ability to afford it, it's becoming more affordable, that there are still a lot of people that for one reason or another don't have computers, they don't have internet access, and what it is that what they're missing out on and what the country may be missing out on because they don't have that access.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that you are I think that you are absolutely right that there is a real misunderstood portion of this debate where that the internet is there are large racial and class divisions in use and adoption of technology. And even just in the tools of technology, if you're African American or Hispanic in the United States, you're probably statistically undersubscribed to broadband, but oversubscribed to cell phones. And that's all the more reason why it's really important for these candidates to, in this election, be using all sorts of different tools and technologies to reach these voters, because you may not be able to reach them all on a single platform. And there's, there's a lot of work that this country needs to do in terms of ensuring that everyone has the skills and capabilities to compete in a workforce where you are just as likely, if you're in Southern Illinois, to be competing with workers in India as you are to be competing with workers in Indiana.
And just going back to the two campaigns we've talked about, who do you think so far has taken the best advantage, made the most of the new possibilities and all of these various ways to communicate?
I think that Obama, as I've mentioned a couple of times, has just been making tremendous use of these resources in ways that few people thought it would be as transformative to this race as it is proving to be.
Well, we're about to the point where we have to finish here. And any last sort of thought that you'd like to leave with folks?
No, I just to reiterate my earlier point, that I really think in this first campaign of the 21st century, as the book's title and thesis argues, we just really need to be focused on where the candidates want to take us 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years down the road. But we can't let this be another short-term election about whatever problems happen to be at the fore, at the end of October. But instead, really look at this as a long-term challenge for the future.
Our guest, Garrett Graff, is editor at the Washingtonian Magazine, where he covers media and politics, writes a lot about the intersection of politics and technology. He also teaches graduate-level internet and social media at Georgetown University. His book, if you'd like to read it, is titled The First Campaign, Globalization, the Web, and the Race for the White House. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. And Mr. Graff, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.